Turn on the and welcome to another episode of the Carpcast Extra. This is the library edition where we talk about individual skills and techniques that are hopefully going to catch you way more fish. This particular episode is about floater fishing. Do you know a thing or two about floater fishing, Mark?
I do. While I'll not claim to be the best at it, I have caught my fair share of floater fish, including my first 20 and first 30 off the top.
No way. My first proper carp fishing was off the top. And considering how much it meant to me, how many of those carp at the time that I caught when I was sort of a 13-year-old teenager, I haven't done it as much in recent years, but fortunately we've spoke to a few experts. We have both caught plenty of fish ourselves on the top, and have Mr. Alan Blair, who is an expert on floater fishing. We've got him coming in to chat as well. But tell us about your first 20 then.
First 20 off the top, it was a local club lake, Sanderson's. It was a fish called The Fish, because it was one of the first 20s ever to be caught from there. There was also a swim it was caught from back then called The Swim. You know, not very imaginative, but I remember the Christen stuff, that like floating putty they used to do, driftwood.
Yeah.
I had a lump of that over a micro swivel, and these fish, they'd been mugging me off on the top. So I'd actually gone into my old float fishing box. I had some 4-pound Bayer Perlon line, which I doubled up. So my thinking about then, if I think it was like 4.4 pounds, so I'm thinking I'll double up and then I've got 8.8, that'll do. Yeah. Whether it actually worked that way or not, but you know, I managed to fasten it on the swivel underneath the putty and straight to a hook. And it was a ridiculously hot day. Yeah, I've pretty much written it off as it's got really hot. I've just been plagued by bream on the top. You know, there's a pattern emerging already there. And this fish, you know, I've seen it bow wave, coming into the swim, ignored every single freebie, and then it must have had some sort of brain fart because it took my hook bait. It was the only one it took, and then I caught it. Ended up with a little bit of an audience around me as well. So that was my first 20 off the top, 20 pound 2 ounce, and I'll post a picture on the page just for a throwback Thursday.
Have you ever had a fish on an absolute blatant like 15 mil pop up or something that's, you know, just free lined it out? Have you ever had a floater caught fish like that?
Yeah, shall I tell you about my first 30 off the top from the same pond?
Go on.
This is not exactly a recommended tactics, but it's a good story, so I'll make it brief. I've gone there fishing, doing an overnighter, and back then I used to wind in around 11:30, pick the wife up from the restaurant where she worked, take her home, then back to the lake, rods out, get my head down. So I've done that, I've got back to the lake, and where we've been float fishing in the day, the mixes have drifted in, and it's pitch black. I can hear a slurping, and it's literally right under the rod tips. So took the rod off the backrest for one of them, just lent it down, and I've got a bottom bait rig on. It's baited up, ready to just be cast out, and I just paid line off the bait runner, so the bait is literally an inch below the surface. And I thought, I'll do that, see if I can mug one off while getting the other two rods sorted. I'd barely sat down, and the rod was bouncing around, nearly jumping in, following the fish, and boom, 32 pound off the top in the middle of the night with a bottom rig.
And so my first floater fishing experiences were on a lake. It was a Prince Albert water known as Whirly Mare. I'd gone down there at first light. It was heavily lily pads all the way round. The swims were like gaps, channels between the pads in most of the swims. I don't even know if it's still like that now. I do have a Prince Albert ticket, so I'd like to go and look. But we were fishing munchies, which were like cat biscuits at the time. I think they'd be called brekkies either before or afterwards. I can't remember which way round it was.
I remember them.
They were like almost like, not clover shapes, but like a three-leafed clover. What would you call that? But they were like, there's three legs, basically. Mm. And the way to prepare them, we used to fish them on the hook. If you soaked them, they went too soggy and they'd just come off. But the trick was, is you put them in like a Tupperware container. You pour boiling water over the top of them, and then you put the lid on. You just only just cover them in boiling water. They soak it up, and they go really rubbery. And you could thread them onto the hook and cast them pretty well. I know you can do dog biscuits the same way. It also meant you could colour them, which is what I used to do at the time. I used to colour them with like whatever food dyes were. Excuse me. Whatever food dyes were in my mum's cupboard, red was always good. And then I used to thread six of them up the line, poke the hook. It was probably like a size 10 at the time. Poke the hook through the middle, then thread it up the line. Keep doing that till you got like six of them, which was enough weight to cast over the pads. And then put a bit of grass below, you know, underneath a hook of the bottom one. Free line it, launch it over the pads, pull it right up to the edge of the pads, and then as soon as you catapulted a few freebies around it, the fish would start slurping. You could hear them actually slurping underneath the pads, and it was even better if you could get the bait in one of the gaps between the pads. They just absolutely loved it. It was like they felt so confident feeding in there. And I remember I'd been snapped up a couple of times, decided to up my line and actually try and catch these bigger carp. We were catching crucians, float fishing at the time. Decided I wanted to catch one of these. I've gone down at first light, sneaked out of the house, because I was only like 12 or 13 at the time. Sneaked out of the house before I was allowed to. I wasn't allowed to go out till it got light. So like I was up all night, dead excited, like probably about 3 o'clock in the morning. It is early in the year as well, like springtime. Probably it must have been June because it was the old close season then, so it must have been like really early into the season, 20th of June, somewhere around there. Did this, flicked it out over the pads, and I'll never forget the feeling of that fish, because obviously you've seen it, aren't you? Just the excitement of the fish slurping it down. Obviously you had to strike pretty hard then. Yeah, but while the munchies were in the water, they're obviously getting softer and softer. So while your hook's in there, it doesn't take much at all to pull a hook through. And once it's, you know, doesn't have to be in the water that long, and you're striking through it basically. And I landed this fish. It was about 6 pound at the time, pretty mirror, which was huge then. And I fished on the surface for a lot of years. When it was warm, I would always fish on the surface. Used to use like slow sinking bread as well. You'd get a chunk of a bread flake. Do you ever remember those double hook rigs people used a little bit before it's got sort of frowned upon? But you would fish some floating crust on one off your controller, and you'd have another slow sinking like a second rig, like coming off your controller with some slow sinking bread. You ever see that?
No, I know the fly fishermen do something very similar, like, you know, two and sometimes three flies, but never really seen or done that with carp.
Yeah, it's bread. I know when we speak to Alan Shorley, he talks about bread quite a bit. It's one of the sort of ultimate baits. You know, it's the ultimate free food for fish. But I remember losing a really big fish, one of the most powerful fish that I ever didn't land, if you know what I mean. I was fishing another lake. It was in Woburn Sands, it was called. It's actually where I caught my first 30. And one of the back bays on there was red hot, and back then when it was hot, I would always go looking for the fish. I don't think that was the keenness of being young, but I'd go looking for the fish, and you know, always cast floaters out, or catapult floaters out, you know, leave it 10-15 minutes, see if the fish are coming up taking, and invariably they used to a lot. I mean, it's, if there's one tip I can advise now, and that is, you know, when it's warm, and even not so warm as we'll move on to, fire some floaters out and see if the fish would come up. I remember Horseshoe as well in the 80s when I fished on there. It was in all conditions, autumn and everything, it was quite common. We were using glugged boilies then. It was quite common. It was always windy on Horseshoe. It was quite common to catapult your baits out, which had been soaked in, you know, some sort of nod oil or fish oil, and it'd make a big clear area on the surface, and then you'd fire floaters or spod floaters into the slack water, and you'd see the fish coming up really quickly. And I don't really know why I don't use that as a location method anymore, just putting floaters out regular. But I was in this back bay on Woburn Sands, and I managed to get the fish going in there, and I'm feeding them. And everybody would tell you the key with floater fishing is get them feeding first. Fire the bait out. As soon as they're coming up, like three at a time, that's probably enough to put a bait amongst them. And it can be so frustrating. You had those days, Mark, where you just can't get the hook bait where your free offerings are, as to where like the fish are taken at that one time. But this particular day I did, the fish took my bait after, you know, I had a few near misses, struck, felt this fish, and it powered off, and it powered really deep underneath, and I ended up having about a 15 minute battle, and it snapped. The line snapped. I was devastated. I have no idea, but it was, at the time, it was, you know, bigger fishing than I'd ever caught before in any lake. So, and then I don't really know why. I think it was when carp fishing got really comfortable and we got bivvies and bed chairs with sleep systems and stuff like that. I just stopped floater fishing, and I walk around with people like Alan Blair now and see, you know, his first choice method is something like that, firing some maggots out, anything slow sinking, bread, maggots. He's caught surface fish on pretty much anything. But remember when the zig bugs first came out from Nash, which were basically like foam glued to a small hook. I remember we were on, I think you might have been there, Mark, we were on, it was called where they had the shows in the Midlands, where the Fishermania is.
Cudmore.
Yeah, we're on there.
Yeah. And I wasn't at that one, but I know what you mean.
Well, we were. It was when the riser pellets from Nash first came out. So the riser pellets, basically, they were bought as floating pellets, but some of them sunk accidentally. Like the smaller one, the bigger ones, there were three different sizes of very small floating pellets, but the smallest one, as soon as they started taking on a bit of water, they started sinking slowly. So if you can imagine, it was an accident at first that turned into one of the most craziest reactions I've ever seen from fish on literally any lake that I've ever cast them into, because it's just something about it, that some are below the surface, some are floating on the surface, and they're all quite small. It turns the fish into a crazy frenzy. The first time I'd seen them in action was on Cudmore. Got to the point where it was when the Nash bolt machines came out as well, which were there's a couple of companies do them now, but they're a definite move on from the bubble floats that we used to use in the 80s and 90s, where you'd these little round balls with air in them, you'd fill them up with water to get some weight, and then cast them out. But with the like the bolt machine type things, they actually act as a self-hooking method on the surface. So I mean, I would always, unless you're freelining, you know, short distance over some pads or something, I would always use some sort of, you know, floating controller bolt machine type thing. We had the controllers in between, didn't we? After bubble floats came the controllers, which were basically like floats, but bubble floats were always better because they work similar to the bolt machine in the fact you've got a lot of resistance, so it does self-hook. And anyway, Cudmore, it got to the point where we had one guy spomming out these riser pellets, basically very small floating pellets, and four of us with fishing rods and controllers casting in amongst, you know, wherever the pellet was landed, and we were getting a bite, a chuck, not always hooking them or landing them. But I was struggling on my one. The lads were getting bites, and this is what blew me away. They were getting bites on the zig bugs, so they weren't even using a floater on, you know, or any sort of real bait on their hook. They were using some foam, some unflavoured foam, basically. And I kept having fish go for them and couldn't take it. And Alan said it was too buoyant. The foam is sticking out too high above the water, and we ended up cutting it down, so it almost looked like it was going to sink. So it was just breaking the surface, and then I started catching straight away, like three casts in a row. I hooked a fish, either landed it or, you know, dropped it off on the way back in. But I didn't really pay attention. If something's too buoyant above the surface, it's hard for the fish to suck it down. And if you're feeding very tiny pellets, which is really easy for the fish to suck down, then I think that they get preoccupied on it. So that's why I asked you about that. Have you ever caught one on like a blatant 15 mil pop-up? Because I think if you fed large size dog biscuits, you know, like 12, 14 mil dog biscuits, you've probably got way more chance of getting a bite on a pop-up.
Yeah, I know when I've used the riser pellets, I've never used them exclusively. I've always mixed calf biscuits and dog biscuits in with them, just so I've got something that I can use as a hook bait out of there as well. Mm. But, excuse me. Remember, the last time I did some serious floater fishing was about, you know, 3 or 4 years back when I moved house. You know, time was limited to... well, it was limited to nothing until the wife went to work and I was supposed to be doing more decorating. I was like, oh, bollocks to this. I'm off out with a floater or down the local gaff just to get a fix. And that was, you know, just, I'd have literally dozens and dozens of like tangerine sized PVA bags full of risers and mixes all tied up. Mm. And instead of, you know, spotted, I would just, you can get a fair bit of distance with those in the catapult. I just go down to my local club late, smash those in, and the fish are really up on them. And also that was a time where out of the, you know, Nash's Zigbug range, he's got some that imitate mixers. I think in the pack there was like a mixer, one that's like full of, like, you know, white fluffy marabou feathers, which, you know, to imitate a piece of bread, and then one that's to imitate riser pellets. It's like, you know, five or six little,
yeah,
little floating balls on the back of the hook, and that is what I was catching on every time.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen those.
Not just carp either. You know, big roach, big rudd were smashing them. Yeah, like a jacuzzi.
That's the thing with the riser pellets, is the little fish like them, yeah, too. It's much easier. I was fishing Cromwell once, which hasn't, it's not got too many small fish in, and the fish went crazy on the riser pellets there. I'd just gone down to see Nathan for a bit, shot round into one of the swims. It was red hot. Blasted a load of pellet out. I had a bit frustrating because I was trying to spawn the pellets out, and obviously they drift a little bit. And I think one of the keys is if you can get your hook bait out and then drop a spawn right on top of the hook bait, so you've got like a spread of bait with your hook bait in the middle of it, you're much more likely to get the bite. But you know what fish are like, they like moving from different you know, different piles of bait at any one time. But another tip is to put a PVA bag, get them going with the spawn, just fill the swim in front of you with your biscuits or riser pellets or whatever you're using, and then so you've got fish, you know, actively looking for the bait all over. Then when you cast out, make a decent size sort of tennis ball size PVA bag of floating gear, and then just hook it onto the end of your rig. No, just hook it onto your hook and cast that out. Obviously it's a much bigger splash as it goes in the water, but PVA melts and your and the freebies are definitely around your hook. Moving on to tactics, have you got a preferred floater setup?
Yeah, I'm pretty much bog standard, to be honest. You know, I'll have a nice, supple, greased main line. You know, keep it on the surface. I find that important, especially if there's a bit of drift. It makes it easy to mend the line and keeping control, you know, keep a straight line. You know, bamming in the line, it's usually whatever got to hand in the last light. Last time, I just found some hemp oil in my box and poured that on the spool. It worked. But now, usually, I get some gink, which is what the fly anglers use.
Hmm.
You know, I use that on my stick float rod as well to keep the line on the surface.
Right.
But you know, without running down, then I'll just use, you know, a bolt machine or a standard little controller. You know, I'll have a little male micro swivel under some sort of like small bead, which will stop the controller to the hook link to the hook. And it is about as simple as that. But the one thing, never trap the float, because controller floats make death rigs as good as leads if you crack them off. So yeah, always have your float running.
Yeah, good eye, good shout. You could, a lot of them have got like the rubber in the bottom of the, you know, the bolt machine type things. They have a little bit of rubber in the bottom, and you can just pull it over your swivel. Like,
yeah, semi-fixed. That's how I'll use, you know, like a small little sleeve over the, you know, like a micro swivel, and then just pull the eye of the controller just onto it. Or like you said, if I'm using the bolt machine, pull the swivel into the bottom of that. But when it gets down to the you know, the hook end, I don't like to use slightly larger hooks than most. You know, I find even though it's quite large for a 10, a size 10 twist is perfect. You've got that wide gate, the straight point. You know, I think a straight point is quite important in this. We're actually striking at the fish, it's not hooking themselves. So you've got to try and, you know, obviously that wide gape and straight point has got more chance of catching than not, than an interned point, definitely. So,
what I'm watching,
you've already hit. Go on. So you've already hit on the point about critically balancing your bait. You know, I've seen a few people that, you know, Lee Birch did an excellent post on his Facebook a while back of how he does it. But it's just make it so your fish just has to suck slightly and poof, that bait is in his mouth. It's the same as critically balancing your pop up on the bottom.
Yeah, you don't want it too buoyant above the surface. And what about your hook link material?
I just use the same hook link, excuse me, stumbling over my words. You know, the same hook link as I do for my zig fishing, your floater or zig lines. You know, I've used the Nash and I've used the Fox one. I like the Fox because they do a 15 pound at the minute as well, which, with the rules on a lot of lakes, of a 15 pound minimum, no matter what you're fishing. So,
yeah,
I've got both of those in my box and I've caught equally well on both, to be fair.
One of the tips on Horton, from where, in the area where Jim Shelley was fishing Horton, there was a quite a big floater, not craze, but it was a common method back then. I know Shelley was doing the days at the time, and a few of them, they tried keeping it quiet for a little while, but you probably got it in your shop, Mark. Preston Innovations make a hook link called Reflow Power. Yeah,
that's good.
It's very supple. It's I do and have used it as a zig line, but it's probably a little too supple for the zig line. You can get the odd tangle, but as a floater line, it's perfect. But this is the mind-blowing thing. They were catching fish, the 30s and 40s in Horton, they were catching at the time. I don't think it was any 50s in there then, but they were catching, you know, multiple fish a day, powerful big fish in fairly deep water. The fish were running, and they were using the 6 pound 12 ounce, which is 0.7 millimetre. Now, we're talking about fishing for big fish, but very, very wary fish. And these fish were getting hammered off the top this particular year. And they were using, you know, sort of 5 foot, 6 foot hook link lengths of this 6 pound 12 ounce line. And they could not snap it. It's something to do with this particular line and the stretch in it. And, you know, I think it's acts almost like an elastic band. And they were, they were not, the couple of people I was speaking to at the time, they were playing fish like they would normally, you know, they weren't playing them gently. They were really, you know, walloping into 30 and 40 pound fish. and fighting, yeah. You know, they were fighting hard, and this 6-pound 12-ounce I've used it and have caught in it. I've also bought, they do an 8-pound 15-ounce one, which is 0.21, but I think if you're fishing somewhere and it's extremely finicky, you've got a size 10 hook and this 6-pound 12-ounce line, which it's almost like double strength the way it works. I think it, you know, maybe it does break at 12 to 15 pound. I've never actually tested it, but I've never actually lost a fish on it. But yeah, check it out. It's in like a blue and black box, Reflow Power. Knot strength on it is really good, and it's a fantastic line. And as I said, you can use it for zigs, but I would, unless these guys, you know, these were all top anglers at the time, unless they were telling me about, you know, I'd never have dreamt of using a 6-pound 12-ounce line. But 6-pound 12-ounce, it's almost 7-pound, and we were using 7-pound Silcast as standard in the 80s and 90s for our all-round fishing.
That was the main line.
That was the main line, yeah.
But I'm just pulling up once with 12-pound, and my mate's just taking the piss out of me, saying, "What you cut? What you after sharks?"
Yeah, exactly. So don't be put off by the strength. I mean, it does go up to, I think the biggest one they do is 12.5. They do an 11-pound, an 8-pound 15, 7-pound 6, and a 6-pound 12. On Horton, they were using the 6-pound 12, and it's, as I said, the diameter of it is 0.17, which seems super thin. But yeah, yeah. It was, I use the same. I tend to use a little wide gape hook, you know, some sort of. I used to use the Drennan Barbel hooks many years ago. Remember those in the green packet? In the size 8, they were quite a small hook then.
Sell a ton of those.
Yeah, they were a good little hook. I've had them open occasionally. But yeah, any sort of size 8 to 10 hook doesn't look too big. And how are you attaching your bait? Are you using a hair rig?
Most of the time I pretty much just side hook a soft mixer, or I'm using one of the imitations.
Yeah.
You know, and since the imitations came out, especially the Nash Riser pellet imitation, it's just so convenient.
I like
two or three a session, and you're not rebaiting every cast, and it's,
I like having the bait right on the back of the hook now. So, you know, using like the Zigbug type things, you've got Fox that do the actual Zigbug. PB products have got some coming out now where you can put foam in the back of it. Obviously, you can flavour the foam. You can cut it right down to get it just sitting above the surface. But if you've got the fish feeding on the top, generally, as in you've got a load of floating pellet out there and mixers, you've got them taking, they're definitely sucking the foam in. As Alan will tell you in a bit, he's even had fish on the foam on the inside of a cigarette butt, you know, when he's had nothing to use and he's got the fish going on the top. You know, he's stripped a cigarette that he's found on the floor. Strip the bit of foam fluffy stuff in the end and caught fish on that. So they will take anything once you get them going. So yeah, I like the idea of Nash do the bread bombs. They do a small one and a big one. Small one's about the size of a Zigaliner from Fox, and they also do quite a big one as well. It's like a band. And you can stuff a load of bread inside that, which I do quite like the idea of that. With the bread, you can obviously get a bit of weight for casting if you are freelining. So,
when you watch likes of, young Carl and Alex videos, they do a hell of a lot of that. And even Alan with the bread bombs, and there's one water near me. You know, it's a very, very tricky, hard work water. But it's also very public, where they're constantly throwing bread in at the bird life. So I might just need to walk around that with a little 10-foot rod, a little rucksack with my flask and Jaffa cakes in, and just look for fish and just do that instead of just getting there crack of dawn, racing to the swims with a barra and standard fishing.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm the same. I use my normal main line. I'll use a normal cart rod. If I'm just going for days floater fishing, I've got a separate, much softer rod, an old 2¼ Northwestern 3 rod, which has got a small bait runner on it. And I do have that set up permanently with a controller in my garage, but I will take it if I'm fishing in the summer and I know it's going to be warm. But yeah, main line straight through to a controller. I don't use a controller. I'll only use either a bubble float or the bolt machine type things, because it's just self-hooking when you see it go on the surface. Then I'll use a 4 foot hook link of this reflow power, and then I'll use either some sort of Zigbug type aligner, Zig aligner, or the Nash bread bombs, and that is pretty much it. The skill is the feeding. And another good tactic is to, if you're feeding, you know, if you're in an actual swim and not roving around too much, and you're going to keep, you know, like you're in the central area of the lake, is feed one area in the middle and fish a zig just under the surface, and then fish your floating your floater set up pretty much, you know, in the same area over the top of it. Leave your zig permanently there, and then keep spomming, feeding, putting bait out. Have you seen these spodcopter rigs that some of the match guys use, Mark?
Spodcopters?
Yeah, so
I haven't. No, you're gonna have to enlighten me on this one.
They use it on places like Drayton, where they're catching a lot of fish and they're catching them quickly. So they use a spom on connected on the end of their lead clip. I think they fish the spom on the lead clip, and then where your swivel is, where you normally put your hook link on, you put like a 2 foot floater type setup on, you know, fairly thin line, and usually something slow sinking, so like bread's perfect for it, something that sinks really slow. You fill your floating spawn mix, or, you know, like a cloudy spawn mix, you fill the spawn, which is on your lead clip, with that, and you've got the rig hanging below it. You cast it all out and let it slowly sink. By the, you know, you leave it a few minutes and then you cast again, so you're constantly depositing bait in the swim, and you're slow sinking a rig sort of into the cloud of your spawn that's dropping. So they use, you know, floating pellets, sinking pellets, ground bait mix, and some flavouring and stuff in the spawn mix. And it's one of the few occasions you want to come. I suppose you can use a spom, but one of the few occasions that a spod is fine, a normal spod. Then obviously, if you get snagged or anything, the spom is just over on a lead clip and can release itself if needed. You're not seeing that rig?
I don't know, but that makes a lot of sense. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, obviously, well-stocked lakes, I think, is the place to use that.
Yeah, I was just thinking there's nowhere where I can, you know, think, you know, I could apply that to my own fishing, but, you know, it's one to put in the back of the mind, because you never know. You never know, you might end up somewhere like, you know, Drayton or Thorpley or somewhere and think, give that a go.
Yeah, I think they call it the spodocopter. Yeah, very interesting. I suppose you could use it in with a helicopter setup and the spom at the end where you would normally put the lead on a, you know, a charred helicopter type setup, and then just have the hook link on beads slightly above it.
Yeah, it is two things that just popped into my head. You know, two blasts from the past. Did you ever use floater cake?
Yes, I've tried it without much success, to be honest. When we used to microwave it.
Yeah, that stuff you'd make in, like, you know, in your mum's best baking tray that you'd ruin. And yeah, only made it once or twice. But the mate off history at the time used to make it quite a lot. And I used to just blag his. You know, he'd cut it up into cubes. And it was, I don't know why it's not caught on, why no one's actually marketing it, because it was damned effective stuff.
There were many many tactics to get boilies to float back in the 80s and 90s. Yeah. I used to read articles about it. You know, most of it involved microwaving them or baking them, didn't it, to get them to float. Yeah. But obviously, we have dedicated pop-ups these days.
Yeah, and here's another blast from the past that I've not done myself for probably 15 years plus, and I've not even seen done as long. The Beachcaster rig.
Yes, it did get banned on a lot of places, but
because it is a way of presenting your floater with no line on the surface, and it is just ridiculously effective.
Okay, do you want to talk us through the setup It works better on shallower lakes because you need to keep the line out of the water.
Yeah, definitely.
So you've got to get your rod almost vertical, like sea fishing style. And you keep all the line out of the water. But can you remember the actual setup, you know, towards the end, at the business end?
If I remember rightly, it was, you know, you'd have quite a heavy lead at the end, you know, length of line, you know, just a, you know, maybe a little bit deeper than what the actual lake was. You'd have like a, you know, a large sea fishing or pike float, another maybe 18 inch of line up that to a swivel, which you have your hook bait, your hook link hanging down, and then the other end of the swivel, because you'd have it, you know, like three way or whatever,
wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. And there's a small lake near me called Bank End. You know, I've seen it used with devastating effect there. I do believe it is banned there now as well. I could be wrong, though. I might have to go down and investigate that one. But, yeah, I also, with the, because you're playing a fish with, you know, quite a bit of tackle, you know, trailing behind it with your float and your lead on the line, I'm not sure it's something I'd want to use on any weedy waters, which is just about everywhere now.
Yeah, pretty much everywhere. But yeah, it was have a Google or research some old school books. You'll see the version of it. But yeah, obviously you cast the lead in, you pull the line tight, your hook link's actually out the water, so you've got no line connected to the bait in the water. It's hanging from your line, which should be at a 45 degree angle from the tip of your rod, which is, you know, as high as you can get it up in the air, and fix it with the line going down 45 degrees to this float and then the lead that's on the bottom. And if the lake was shallow enough, I know it was used on Cuttle Mill a lot in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Here, but it was
go on. There's Taylor who done a video on there with it.
Yes, he did. Yes.
Back in the day,
yes. But yeah, it did get banned. I saw it being used on the Split Lake on the Yateley Complex once. Saw somebody on there. Mm. Yeah, very interesting. But I think using you know, the finest strong hook link you can get these days, such as that reflow, or there are some good zig floater lines around now, sort of purpose made, you're surprising how thin you can go with the diameter and with the sort of setup that we're using, and not get into any trouble. But yeah, let's get some experts in. So I'd like to welcome to the Carpcast an expert in floater fishing, which is Mr. Alan Blair. How are we doing, pal?
All right, mate. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm not too bad at all. I've just seen you release a short film on the Nash TV regarding floater fishing. Pretty epic time with all the lads down at, was it the Bluebell Complex?
We went to Fort Pley to start with, then we went to Horseshoe, finished off at Bluebell. Yeah, 24-hour round trip.
I spoke to somebody actually who was on the lake at that time, and they said you were trying to catch a fish from each lake on the Bluebell Complex. Was it something like
it
that?
Would have been nice, mate. Yeah, we sort of set our stall out to try and get one from each venue. But, you know, how fishing goes, mate. Sometimes it's not particularly easy, and that was, you know, a case in hand on that day. Very challenging fishing.
So, as most people who follow you will know, your biggest strength in angling is seeing the fish and catching them right in front of you, from stalking them in the edge to getting them going on the top. So, we're talking about surface fishing here. How do you get them going? How do you get them to take the hook bait? What are your tactics? Talk us through how you approach that if you think the fish are going to feed.
Surface fishing, why I do it so much, fundamentally, it's because of that sight element, Jamie. And from a very young age, I realised that if I can see the fish, I can see their behaviour, I can see how they're feeling, I can see how they react to bait. And that's why I think I've honed my energies towards that style of angling so much, because the moment you cast out into the lake is the moment you don't really know exactly what's going on. Yeah, you might see shows, you might see bubbling, clouded water, etc., etc., but you don't get a true representation of exactly how many fish are in the swim and how those fish are feeling or feeding, and that's why I love float fishing so much. A lot of people will tell you, you know, you've got to get their confidence going, and I can't really disagree with that. However, pick your moment, you know. Don't sit there and feed a bucket of mixers and then watch the fish all drift off because they're full up. You know, I will cast probably a lot of sooner than others, because I don't want to miss opportunities. You know, it's all good and well if there's 50 fish in front of you all up for a munch. You know, you're going to catch a few fish, but it might be a lethargic day. Take the bluebell day in question. The fish weren't up for a munch. They weren't up for getting for a bucket of riser pellet or a bucket of floaters. And I probably fed, you know, at best a couple of handfuls of bait. And I had to cast very quickly. So I would say that to people that are going to go out there and do some floater fishing. Yes, there's a time and a place for building the fish's confidence up and getting them troughing. But conversely, take the opportunities when they come. You know, if you can see a fish taking bits of scum off the surface or whatever, then get maybe a few mixes out there and get your rook bait out in amongst it. Because just like bottom bait feeding, they don't always trough the red off.
Nice. Have you ever seen a fish on the top, maybe a solitary one on its own, and the first thing you've done, you've just cast a hook bait at it, see if it's interested, or would you always feed first?
Nah, I have, and it breaks the rules of floater fishing, you know, those textbook rules of feed the fish, get them confidently taking, then make your cast. No, I am that guy who's for sure seen a fish, an opportunist, cast towards it, and it has come up and nailed it. And that's when, you know, pimping up your rook bait or giving them a special rook bait really does sort of stack the odds in favour. Of late, I've been soaking them in a glug, and then I've been applying a really nice stick mix. And when you drop them in the water, we're talking half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, you've got all of this goodness seeping off it. Yeah. And I think you present a floating bait like that in the vicinity of a fish milling around near the surface, very much like fishing a single in winter. You know, they're drawn to that, they're attracted to that, and sometimes they stick it in their mouth and you hook them.
Have you, I know the answer to this, but our listeners may not have heard it, but improvised with crazy hook baits and stuff?
Yeah, you know, over the years, especially at a younger age, marshmallows and Maltesers and sugar puffs and all manner of things. As I've grown older, I'm more and more conscious of really trying to match my hook bait to what I'm feeding, though. That said, I can recall a session probably a couple of years ago now. I turned up at Farlow's and I wasn't supposed to be fishing. I just went there for an open day. Carl and Alex were fishing. And I walked around to their swim. Hey, getting on, boys? Yeah, we've had loads. I said, can I have a rod and have a cast? Of course you can. They proceeded to pass me a rod with a pink pop-up on. Yeah. I said, you're having a laugh. 15 mil pink pop-up. I said, you're having a laugh. Like, no, Alan, trust me, it's the only thing we can get a bite on. I said, no way, I want to change it. They said, no, don't change it, just make a cast. There was a few fish, and I mean really taking the odd bait, really taking the odd bait. They said, cast out there. I've cast out. It's just come up and nailed it, Jamie.
Just gone straight for it.
Absolutely nailed it. Now, if someone had told me that and I hadn't witnessed it myself, I would have laughed it off and said, impossible. But it pays dividends to change colours, just like when you're bottom bait fishing. Chop and change to find the right colour hook bait or right size or shape of hook bait on the day in question or the particular venue.
When the riser pellets first came out, I noticed that they were like crack to carp. For those that haven't seen them, they're like very small floating pellets, aren't they? Two or three different sizes.
Three different sizes. A 1 mil that almost immediately breaks the surface film and starts to sink down very slowly. A 2 mil after a period of time will also take in enough water and start sinking down. And a 4 mil that always stays on the surface as a floating bait.
Yeah, so obviously they're very small particles and pellets, and what I found is that carp used to get preoccupied on them, and it was very hard to get them to actually take your hook bait. So at the time, what I did, I was actually using the Zig bugs that you sell and trimming them down so that they just broke the surface, very small. And I found I could get a bite like that. I mean, have you fine-tuned it? Have you found the perfect way if you're just feeding risers?
I'll hold my hands up, mate. I've ruined some sessions, blowing chances by overfeeding the riser pellet. It's a bit like putting in too much maggot or too much hemp. And then trying to put a hook bait in amongst that. You know, there's a lot of free offerings out there for them to eat. And if you've got a dozen fish uptaking floaters and you only put out, say, 6 sponds of riser pellet, that's a lot of bait on the surface of the water. And unless those fish are 100% up for a munch, you could very, very quickly see them have a feed and leave before they even get round to considering taking hook bait. So be careful with it. I can say, hand on heart, it's one of the greatest baits I've ever seen in my life for fish reacting to it and getting on it and munching. Just don't put too much of it in too soon, you know. Little and often, let them have a munch and mix it up with some other bits. Put some chunks of bread in there. Definitely put some 11 mil floaters or some dog biscuits in there, some larger particles that will replicate potentially what you're fishing on the hook.
And what would be your go-to hook bait at that point?
Again, here, this is all the time, Jamie. You know, you've fished a lot longer than I have, but I still feel I've done a good apprenticeship and I'm still learning. Last week I was on holiday with the girls, and I've always, or for a number of years now, been sort of fishing a hair very, very tight to the shank of the hook. And I caught 70 fish in this week in question, and I just couldn't be bothered. Wow. A bit lazy, really, to keep messing around with hair stops and needles, etc. So I started side hooking 12mm Scopex squid pop-ups with a little bit torn off the bottom just to open the gape up a little bit. Yeah. I think it's the ultimate floater hook bait presentation.
No, you know,
I only really grasped that last week. For sure I've side hooked pop-ups before, but to catch a large number of fish in a week and see how many I think I lost one, I think I missed a couple. Now my ratio of normally using a hair rigged floating bait wouldn't have been that good, for sure.
Yeah,
you know, so you're always learning all the time. The fish are feeding different each time, but the next time I go out float fishing, for sure I'm going to be side hooking 12mm Scopex squid pop-ups with a little bit torn off the bottom to open the gate.
It's kind of similar to what I was just saying about the zig bugs, just trimming those down, because that's almost like a side hook bit of foam, isn't it? Have you used a lot of foam and stuff as a pop-up hook bait? Have you had much success?
You know, the danger with foam, cork, pop-ups to a degree is the buoyancy. You know, it's like a reverse critical balance effect. When those fish are going around, they're taking dog biscuits or riser pellets, they're regulating their suck the same as if they'd be feeding on hemp or particles or maggots on the bottom. And if they're going around their business having a lovely munch and they come across a cork ball, for example, and they try and suck that cork ball in, it doesn't go in. You know, it's very, very difficult to take that bait off the surface of the water into their mouth. So be really conscious of critically balancing your hook bait. So when they're going around sucking, when they come to a hook bait and they suck like they've sucked for the last 15, 20 minutes, an hour, that hook bait goes in the same. So a pop-up with a heavy steel hook is great, but a piece of cork is just too buoyant. A piece of foam is just too buoyant.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. I know with the zig bugs, I was trimming them down until you could almost see it not breaking the water anymore.
You've got it. You've nailed it, mate. Then you've got the perfect presentation. But a big cube of foam or a round cork ball, nah. It's too difficult for them to suck it in. Maybe if you put some putty underneath it or a split shot. You've got to think critical balance bottom baits or pop-up rigs. You know, a lot of us want them to sink really, really slowly through the water, so when the fish approach and suck, it flies back into their mouth. And surface fishing is no different. It's just on the surface of the water.
What we see on the surface in that situation, you know what you're saying about the fish regulating the suck and blows, and you know, they'll have two or three goes at hook bait, then maybe shy off it. How much do you think that replicates what's going on the bottom?
I think quite similar. You know, again, this is always my frustration with using bite alarms and bottom bait rigs. I can assume things, but I can't prove it. And unless I had an underwater camera down there. But I do believe it's the same. I believe on certain days, they're troughing on the bottom, they're tearing it up, you can't really put a foot wrong. You cast a rig anywhere near it, you catch them. Same with float fishing. You turn up on the right day, right weather conditions, etc., etc. Put a load of risers and floaters out there, they go mental. Conversely, it can be very, very tricky. Very tricky. And I think, you know, something I've learnt over the last 2 years, you want to have good floater results, don't expect to get them in July and August. You want to be there at the start. You want to be that angler there with their floater gear in their motor from April, really, just in case we get a couple of days of 20 degrees. Just in case they all hit the surface, that's when you're going to have your big hits, definitely.
And I always remember Terry Hearn saying that one of the most overlooked times for floater fishing, as he used to do a lot, was first light.
Agree, 100%. Agree. Yeah. I think they're stupid. Not stupid, sorry, that degrades a carp. I think they've had a little rest through the night. They haven't had a lot of disturbance. The banks have been quiet and they're sort of waking up themselves ready for it to get ahead of them. and I think that's the time to hit them. I used to believe it was the evening. I used to think the sort of witching hour, but I don't now. I think actually 3:30 in the morning till 7 is the optimum time on the right weather conditions to catch float or caught carp.
Fantastic. And just to wrap it up, can you just describe your setup from sort of the reel all the way to the hook? A complete novice, how what do they need to go and buy?
You need a relatively soft rod, but I probably wouldn't go down the textbook route. A lot of people would say a 2.5, a 2.75. I think you want at least a 3. If you're fishing for decent fish, 20 pound plus, in potentially weedy or snaggy situations, you need the backbone there. If you're floater fishing with a float, a controller or a bolt machine, then yes, a 12 foot rod is the ideal choice because you can mend the line better and keep the direct line of contact between you and the fish. Carry some different size controllers. I love the tiny little Drennan ones for short range work. Conversely, I've got all the sizes of bolt machine if I need to fish up to 100 yards out. Don't forget the margins. Do not forget in the edge. And I'll often have a very short 6 foot rod just with a hook tied on, ready to free line baits to it. And again, the big one for me over the last sort of 5-6 years has been the zigging. You know, it doesn't have to be a one rod tactic. You can go and use your bite alarms. It frees your hands up, it frees your eyes up more, you can regulate the feed better, and you've got multiple rods out in the water with chances of more bites.
And what sort of hook size are you using on the surface?
For example, last week when I've been side hooking these pop-ups of size 8, you can't go too big, potentially because of the weight of the steel is going to sink the hook bait or it's going to be too visible to them. But a 10, 8, 7. I've personally never been one of these guys that have gone down to, for example, a 6 pound line and a size 14 hook. I've never felt the need to. I think you're running too much of a risk, especially when you're fishing for a fish you potentially really want to catch. So, like all carp fishing, make sure you use a balanced setup for the situation that you're angling in.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, thank you for giving us a few floater tips.
Thanks for giving us a call. Lovely speaking to you, Jay, as always.
There are other times of year that are certainly worth trying a floater as well, Mark. You ever caught a fish on a floater in winter?
Not that I recall, but I do remember on the... I mean, I'm discounting all the, you know, ridiculously overstocked lakes here where it's possible any day of the year, unless it's iced up. But remember Elstow One up the deep end, you know, Martin Clark and one or two other people used to always winkle one or two off the top, and big fish as well, you know, in the depths of winter. It was over the deep water, it's only 20 foot plus, high pressure conditions.
Yeah, and in it was possible. It was in December, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was December time, and that's the time of year when the fish, I think one of the things, as I said before about horseshoe and stuff, just sometimes putting the floaters out is enough, because if the fish are in the upper third of the water, they're going to see it, and it's generally an area that they're not wary of being caught, because they're... this applies specifically to deeper lakes, I think. Yeah, if you got a lake, you're fishing gravel pits at an average of 5 or 6 foot. Even when the fish are in the upper thirds of the water, they're only 3 foot above, you know, all the anglers' baits and all the little traps that we've set. And I would guess that pressured fish are wary most of the time on shallower lakes. As soon as you start getting to 10 foot plus, and the deeper the lake, the more responsive they are, I think, to A zigs and B floaters. And Martin Clark proved that many, many times on Elstow, and at all times of year. But I think especially in the winter, when those, you know, if you've got 30 foot of water and the carp are sitting in that top third, you know, in December, in January, and they're sitting there because maybe the thermoclines or because it's comfortable, sometimes just the physical act of putting the floaters out and seeing if the fish come up for them is enough for them to go, oh, look at that. It's because it's free food for them. They're not they feel so comfortable and safe over that depth of water that they're just not wary in any way whatsoever. And in my experience, the deeper the water, the more receptive to floaters they are. And I think they spend more of their day nearer the surface than nearer the bottom. You know, they go down to the bottoms on bite times, maybe first light and maybe dark, when they want to feed, and the rest of the time they're cruising in the upper third. And I think just the trigger of putting bait in can sometimes be enough. And you must remember the times, Mark, where you didn't know where the fish were, and your automatic thing, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, it was quite common. You would just catapult floating bait out and see if the fish came up. You'd catapult in a few swims, have a walk around and see if the fish appeared.
Yeah, I do remember that. I mean, I remember I was on the local lake near me, a little club lake, you know, fishing there. It was... it wasn't, you know, winter, but we were talking about, you know, March, April time. It still wasn't you know, really warm or hot. But, and I don't even remember why I did it, but, you know, I got a couple of rods cast out to some reeds. The wind was really squally, just kind of like, you know, circling the lake. And I just put some mixes out. They were just old, mouldy things at the bottom of my bag, so I just put them out. And right on the wind line, you know, where it really started hitting the water, they started taking. I was like, oh, wow, what are you? No, then I did actually catch one.
Yeah, the wind line's a good area, actually.
Anytime.
I found and it goes to show that maybe the fish has just sat there all the time. Until you put floaters out, you just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I did remember that day I did catch off every single rod off the top and the bottom. But it was the bonus fish.
Have you ever
a bonus fish can be a biggie.
Have you ever floater fished at night?
Yes.
That can be
devastating. I guess it's awkward for the obvious reasons. But, you know, you're more, you know, touching for the bite. But, like you say, it's devastating. It just takes away not only our senses, but, you know, the carp sense. And become less wary. Most people, this has been a few people floater fishing, they've got their rods out and they're having a barbecue or whatever, they're not floater fishing, and carrying on into the darkness, it can be, and you know, especially being up at the crack of dawn as well and drifting some mixes around.
Yeah, Terry Hearn always used to say his favourite time to floater fish is first light, and that my early experiences of floater fishing were at first light. And dusk as well. I think those changing light levels are good on the surface and the bottom, especially in summer. You know, if you can get up at first light, get some mixes out. And if you're ever in a lake that's got pads, you can hear them. You know, especially in the margins, you can hear them. It's quite easy if you've got pads in front of you. I remember fishing a lake in the Gloucestershire area in the late 80s, early 90s, not too far from Horseshoe actually. Adelstrop Lake it was called, and that had pads, you know, like groups of pads, like in the margins just in front of you, and you would hear them in the night. You'd be laying your bivvy quite close to the water, you hear the fish slurping. So what you could do, you could free line floater, you could just free line it over the pads or get it in one of the gaps right in front of you, put, you know, a few handfuls of floaters around it every time you felt like it, and just put the rod on your buzzer, put the bait runner on. You could leave it all night, because obviously the pads is trapping your line, so it's not blowing around or moving. And
remember what we used to call those noises? Cloopers.
Cloopers, yeah. wasn't there a book or something, Casting for Cloopers or something like that?
I do remember that noise. It'd be a...
Yeah. It's quite an exciting noise when you hear that at night. You know, the carp are so close to you. If we have to, should we summarise then floater fishing?
Yeah, you know, we'll start off getting the fish feeding first. So you've got your, you know, your mix, you know, be it riser pellets, tiny pellets, you know, your Matchman's expander pellets are a good bait as well. They all float.
Yeah, I do think you want some very slow sinking stuff in there as well. A couple of small items or even like a cloud, you know, something cloudy in there. Do you remember the old carnation as well you could put in?
Carnation milk.
Carnation, yeah, that would really make a cloud in that mix. Feed, get them feeding, what next?
Yeah, feeding, get them feeding a bit more. Get the feed confidently, wait till all you need is to get that one cast, slowly draw it into position, and competition, that's what you want, that's the word I was looking for. Get them competitively feeding, you know, take a bit of time to do that rather than rushing it, and then that take can happen almost instantly.
Yeah, completely agreed. You want a decent strength but fine hook link. use some sort of controller. I prefer the ones with resistance, like the bolt machines, because you'll find it will, you will self hook the fish, especially if you're using some sort of zigger liner or bait right on the back of the hook, or obviously a hair rig as well. I always found with light line and the hair rigs that it quite often twisted a bit when with small hooks and light lines. When you pulled it tight, the hair would twist just round the side, and I never liked how it sat in the water. Whereas with some sort of bread bomb or zigger liner, you can just get it perfect every time. Cast amongst the fish, you can use a PVA bag hooked on to your hook full of floaters as well to help guarantee that you've got bait around your hook. Wherever possible, maybe fish a zig just under the surface if you're feeding regularly. But I have seen people catch on blatant boilies. Roger Bacon, Carpcast regular, he had a 57-pound common from Kevin Nash's Copslakes this year on a day that didn't look obvious for surface fishing, but he did see the fish. He fed a few floaters that he saw, and he had no hook baits, so he freelined a 15mm pop-up, and he had a few casts. Well, he was chasing he saw the fish, he was chasing it for 2 hours until he got that perfect one where he just managed to drop the, because if you cast too close, if you're fishing for a single fish that you've seen on the surface and you cast too close to it, you'll spook it. So what you're trying to achieve is you work out like the routes that the fish is taking, and then you try and cast at a safe distance in front of the fish, where the fish, you know, is not close enough to spook it, but where the fish is going to come across your hook bait, and that can be the frustrating thing sometimes. But he said he spent 2 hours doing that, and eventually got it in the perfect spot. He said the fish started swimming forward, it just clocked it, and it beelined straight for this 15mm pop-up and yammed it in one go. He said, you know, 6 months of chasing that fish, and it was that easy. It just saw it and yammed it. I remember Jim Shelley telling a story on Toll Pits, very similar. They got the fish going, and he had no floater gear, but he managed to get him going on the surface. And I think he was spotting out like kilos and kilos of chum mixer, and he didn't have any floater gear. He had his 15-pound main line, and he had a 15mm pop-up, and then it was one of the big ones. I think it was one of the 40s at the time. You know, the Toll Pits was a notoriously pressured, tricky fish. And he said he had this pop-up in a sea of chum mixers. It was in his first book, this. And he said that this fish, I forget which one it was, but it clocked the pop-up, and it just made a beeline for it. And just like that, on the most unconventional setup ever, 15-pound line, a big dobbing pop-up, you know, bright orange or yellow or something, this fish just beelined for it and had it. So sometimes just being that blatant or having something that sticks out like that can be the key. Anything else to add, Mark, or is that it for floater fishing?
No, it may be pitch black outside now, but I'm wanting to get floater fishing. It's got me absolutely fired up for this. I'm going to
It's made me want to get the floater rod out this year and, you know, make the effort, because it's not something I do as a first choice, and it used to be when I was young, so we've inspired ourselves.
Yeah, it's... Yes, and hopefully we've inspired one or two people out there, so let us know what you catch.
Carpcast Extra.